This is how the book starts. What gets me most are not the scary scientific studies about melting glaciers, the ones I used to avoid. It's the books I read to my two-year-old. Looking for a Moose is one of his favorites. It's about a bunch of kids that really, really want to see a moose. Now, the joke is that there is a moose hiding on every single page of this book, but the kids don't see it. And at the end of the book, all the moose come out of hiding, and the kids proclaim, "We've never, ever, ever, ever seen so many moose." Now, on about the 75th reading, it suddenly hit me. He might never see a moose.
That's author and activist Naomi Klein reading from her latest book, This Changes Everything: Capitalism versus the Climate. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact. Today, we'll hear excerpts from a talk Klein gave at Town Hall Seattle on how climate change is the fight of our lives and how to turn fear into action.
When fear like that used to creep through my armor of climate change denial, I would do my utmost to stuff it away, change the channel, click past it. Now I try to feel it. But what should we do with this fear that comes from living on a planet that is dying, made less alive every day? First, accept that it won't go away, that it is a fully rational response to an unbearable reality. Next, use it. Fear is a survival response. Fear makes us run. It makes us leap. It can make us act superhuman. But we need somewhere to run to. Without that, the fear is only paralyzing. So the real trick, the only hope, really, is to allow the terror of an unlivable future to be balanced and soothed by the prospect of building something much better than many of us had previously dared hope. Because the thing about a crisis this big, this all-encompassing, is that it changes everything. It changes what we can do, what we can hope for, what we can demand from ourselves and our leaders. It means there is a whole lot of stuff we have been told is inevitable that simply cannot stand. And it means that a whole lot of stuff we've been told is impossible has to start happening right away. Can we pull it off? All I know is that nothing is inevitable. Nothing except that climate change changes everything. And for a very brief time, the nature of that change is still up to us. So, that concludes the reading part of this evening. So, the reason I chose this title is not because I think my book will change everything, but because I think climate change changes everything. And I think that it's important for us to understand that we have procrastinated for so long that there are now no non-radical solutions left on the table. So if we stay on the road we're on, we face radical changes to our physical world. This is what the vast majority of climate scientists tell us, and now what some of our most conservative state institutions are telling us. The World Bank, the International Energy Agency, PricewaterhouseCoopers tell us that if we stay on the road we are on, we are headed towards warming of between 4 and 6 degrees centigrade. That's 10.7 Fahrenheit on the high end. That is incompatible with anything that we might call organized, civilized society. All the models break down, really, after 3 degrees. I mean, the scientists tell us they don't know what this would look like beyond the fact that it would be radical change. It would be whole, huge cities underwater, whole countries disappeared. It would be massive crop failure, and possibly much worse. All we have to do to arrive at this scary place is nothing. All we have to do is not react as if this is an existential crisis. This is known as business as usual. Being us, only more so, because that's what we do. We grow more and more and emit more and more every year. So that's one radical scenario on the table. Another radical scenario that I discuss in the book is what's increasingly being taken seriously among the very serious people, and that is intervening in the climate system with radical technologies at a global scale, sometimes called geoengineering, to try to make those outcomes less disastrous, potentially making them more disastrous. We don't know. You can't find out before you do it because you can't build a model of the climate system to scale. So, yeah, I spent a fair bit of time hanging out with the would-be geoengineers, the smartest guys in the room who are talking about fertilizing the oceans, pumping sulfur into the stratosphere, solving the problem of pollution with more pollution. That's pretty radical, dimming the sun. Now, the good news is that it's not too late to prevent these radical physical and engineering scenarios. But the way we do that at this point involves radical changes to our political and economic system. I spent a lot of time in the book talking about the need to challenge this so-called free market ideology, because I feel like we can spend a lot of time talking about various solutions, cap and trade versus cap and dividend, and we lose sight of the fact that actually, you know, none of it's happening, right? Certainly not at a national level, certainly not at the at a level that will get us anywhere near where we need to go. And that has to do with the ideology that has swept our world. So the argument I make about why we have failed so miserably to rise to this challenge, I mean, and the fact that we've failed is now beyond debate. Since our government started meeting in 1990 to come up with a plan to reduce emissions, global emissions have gone up by 61%. So that is not a good record. And there are all kinds of theories that have been put forward to explain this inaction. We sometimes hear that it's just human nature, that this crisis seems too far off and that we're hardwired to respond only to immediate threats. But this, you know, this rationale doesn't really ring true anymore because, of course, climate change is looking more and more like an immediate threat. It certainly looked like an immediate threat when Superstorm Sandy flooded Wall Street. Not that Wall Street has changed its behavior in any way. So this is one of the rationales. The other rationale is just that it's too complicated, right? That you have to get all of these countries to come together and agree on a set of rules, and it's just impossible. We hear this a lot. But of course, our governments have come together and they have agreed on all kinds of things, whether it's the Montreal Protocol on ozone depletion, whether it's arms treaties. But what about the creation of the World Trade Organization? What about a global trade architecture with binding rules that our governments have managed to build in this very same period when they were failing to deal with the climate crisis? So clearly, we can cooperate and come together if the interests are aligned with those in power. So I think that, you know, there's little bits of truth in all of these rationales and some that I haven't mentioned, but I think that we haven't paid enough attention to one of the biggest obstacles to change, which is just bad timing, bad historical timing. And by this I mean that scientists have known about climate change for a long time, but the point where we lost all plausible deniability, we the public, was really 1988. That was the year that James Hansen testified on Capitol Hill that he now had a high degree of certainty that there was a connection between emissions and warming. That was the year, by then, 87% of Americans knew about global warming. And that year, when the editors of Time magazine needed to choose their man of the year, they decided not to give it to a man. They were still only giving it to men. But man of the year 1988 was planet Earth, the planet in peril. And it was a really interesting essay that accompanied that cover story, which talked about how climate change really called into question the whole Western civilizational paradigm of dominance-based thinking, the idea of the earth as a machine. It traced it back to Francis Bacon. It was this really interesting essay to read in Time magazine. You could never imagine it appearing today. And there was, you know, speaking to people who were involved in the movement at that time, there was actually really a feeling that this was the dawn of a new consciousness, this moment. And then the Berlin Wall collapsed the next year, 1989. This was the moment when Francis Fukuyama declared history over, when the ideology that in most parts of the world is called neoliberalism declared victory over all other economic models. And it was then exported around the world. 1988, the same year that Hansen testified, was the year that Canada and the U.S. signed the historic free trade agreement that was then expanded into NAFTA, became the paradigm used, the model for future bilateral and multilateral trade deals. A few years later, the World Trade Organization was formed. So you had these two parallel processes. Now, this was a problem, and it was a problem not just because the global economy, as it was being called, that was being created, was a particularly high emissions one, but because the ideology of neoliberalism had as its pillars privatization, deregulation, cuts to taxes paid for with cuts to social services, now called austerity, never-ending austerity, all locked in through this architecture of free trade or investor rights deals. Now, what I do in the book is show how each one of these pillars of this ideological project that so successfully spread around the world has stood in the way of what we need to do to respond decisively to the climate threat. And I'll just give you a few quick examples. I mean, a lot of this is obvious. Take austerity, right? I mean, the idea that, I mean, in my lifetime, all I have known of the public sphere is its dismantling. You know, my parents' generation built things. But since I have been a conscious adult, it has only been about stopping the cuts, stopping the attacks. We don't get to build things anymore. And you see the direct clashes because, of course, if we're going to respond to climate change, we need to invest seriously and on a large scale in not just protecting the public sphere, but reinventing it. And we see the clash when disaster strikes. I mean, you see it in this country during Hurricane Katrina, that clash between heavy weather and weak, neglected infrastructure, a government that doesn't seem to be home, can't seem to find New Orleans. We saw it during Superstorm Sandy, where, you know, if you have these widely divergent experiences of a natural disaster, or not a natural disaster, but, you know, if you have resources, you're kind of okay. But if you're in public housing that has been allowed to decay, the lights are out for weeks and weeks, no one shows up, and it was, you know, a bunch of, you know, 20-somethings from Occupy Sandy, as it was called, who were doing frontline work, which was, you know, amazing. But, you know, this is happening all over Europe. In Greece, the fire trucks don't have spare tires. Going into forest fires, I mean, Greece is a tinderbox. And this is how austerity is playing out in that country. At the same time, in the name of exiting austerity, Greece is being told that they need to drill for oil and gas in the Ionian and Aegean Seas, which is madness. Because, you know, this is a country whose two major sectors are tourism and fisheries, right? So, you know, when I call the book Capitalism versus the Climate, people say, well, that's divisive, you know? But the thing is capitalism is already waging war on the climate. And so the point of this is, you know, I think that there are different levels of denial. You know, we talk a lot about this, a right-wing denial where it's really obvious and it's easy to laugh at the people at Fox News. But I think we all engage in our own versions of climate denial. And one of the reasons why we have to stop is that that if we look and let ourselves feel the depth of this crisis, we have some of the most powerful arguments we've ever had to argue for a saner economic system.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to Naomi Klein speaking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate.
I mentioned spending half my adult life in BC. The other half I spend in Ontario. And Ontario has had the most ambitious emission reduction program in North America. It was lauded by many people in this country, including Al Gore, for its extremely ambitious plans to get 100% off coal. This is Canada's most populous province by 2015. And the Green Energy Act was introduced in 2009 in the midst of the economic crisis. And it was introduced because of concern about climate change, but it was primarily introduced because of concerns about unemployment, because Ontario is an economy that is extremely reliant on manufacturing, and in particular, car manufacturing. And our auto sector was getting decimated by the fact that the big three automakers were on their knees at this point. And it was easier to close Canadian plants than to close American plants when you're going to the American government for a massive bailout, which is what was happening at that time. So there were huge numbers of layoffs in the manufacturing sector in Ontario. So very smartly, the Ontario Liberal government introduced this green energy plan that had these ambitious emission reduction targets, but also had very ambitious job creation targets, and required that any company, but there were also non-companies, co-ops, and so on, communities that wanted to benefit from Ontario's new feed-in tariff program, had to manufacture 40 to 60% of their equipment in Ontario. So it was a job creation plan. It was about rebuilding our moribund manufacturing sector. And I profile this company in the book called Silfab, which was sort of like the poster child for how this was supposed to work, because it's a solar plant on the outskirts of Toronto that opened up in a closed-down auto parts factory. So it was the perfect symbol, like old economy dying, new economy opening. All these workers who had lost their jobs at Chrysler and Magna, which is a big auto parts manufacturer, got jobs on the assembly line making solar panels for this new program. And 31,000 manufacturing jobs were created. So all is going well. But then Japan and the European Union challenged Ontario's green energy plan at the World Trade Organization and argued that requirement that a certain percentage of the jobs remain local was discrimination against their companies, against European companies and Japanese companies. And the WTO ruled in their favor, and Ontario lost. And rolled over very, very quickly, in fact, in part because the Canadian government wasn't about to fight for renewable energy when this is an extension of the oil and gas industry, as you may have noticed. But we're seeing more and more of these cases. This is not an isolated case. The U.S. has challenged China's renewable energy subsidies, India's renewable energy subsidies, and it's tremendously ironic because you go to, you listen in on a summit like the one that just happened in New York, and it's all about governments sort of pointing the finger at each other. You're not doing enough. No, you're not doing enough. Oh, I won't lead. No, you lead, right? But in fact, what these governments are doing is running to the World Trade Organization and trying to knock down each other's windmills at precisely the moment when we need all of our governments to be rolling out the most ambitious plans they can, and to do it in a way that will get political buy-in, right? I mean, this was about a just transition. This was about supporting a sector that was getting hit hard and having a just transition to the new economy. And we were told that's not allowed. And in the book, I quote Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who talks about how absurd it is that we are leaving the fate of the planet in the hands of what he calls silly lawyers who didn't even understand the issue when they wrote the rules. Nonetheless, it is happening. So another pillar of the neoliberal era, of course, is privatization. And I want to talk a little bit how this, the way in which so many of our cities, states, provinces have sold off key sectors that are central to the energy transition that we need to enact is standing in the way. Now, many of you have heard a lot about Germany's transition to renewable energy, which is a really, it's a complicated case. You know, it's not all perfect, but nonetheless, it is definitely worth appreciating that a highly industrialized economy like Germany that does not have a lot of sun has managed in a decade and a half to go from 6% of its electricity coming from renewable energy to 25% coming from renewable energy, mostly wind and solar, most of it decentralized. So this is a real success story and one that shows that when we want to and the political will is there, we can move quickly, you know? And we need those success stories. One of the things we don't hear about the German transition is that one of the things that has allowed Germany to transition as quickly as it has is that in hundreds of cities and towns, big cities as well as small towns, citizens have voted and decided democratically to take back control over their electricity grids from the private players that privatized them in the 1990s. And they're doing this because they want to be part of this energy transition. They want their power to come from clean energy, and the private players are not willing to move fast enough. It's also that they want the money from the power generation to stay in the community. So it's both addressing the austerity crisis and climate change at the same time. It's the problem is not just that it's dirty energy. It's also that the money is just hemorrhaging from communities into shareholders' pockets, and that's not acceptable either. So it's become a pro-democracy movement, it's become an anti-austerity movement, and it's a climate movement. And these are the types of paradigms that we need, I think, to win. And it's also starting to spread. It's happening in this country too, you know, and it's been so powerful in this part of the world. I really do think that the fossil fuel industry did not know what they were in for when they decided to build so many tentacles through the Pacific Northwest. And this, in many ways, is the flip side of the carbon boom that we're in the midst of, because, of course, you know, the fossil fuel companies are doubling down. They're building all kinds of new infrastructure. They're doubling down on some of the dirtiest carbon sources. They have to build all this infrastructure, and it takes them into territory that is distinctly hostile. And this, you know, I used to say that the World Trade Organization built our coalitions for us. So in many ways, the fossil fuel companies are building our coalitions for us by their sheer ambition of their coal trains and their oil trains and their pipelines and their LNG terminals and the rest of it. You know, in Canada, one of the most exciting parts of the emergence of this fossil fuel resistance, as our friend Bill McKibben calls it, is the way in which it is building really powerful ties between native, non-native, and native communities. And it's... I think, you know, whenever there's a big resource battle, we see these connections, but there's something new happening. And we saw this really clearly with the emergence of Idle No More. I think what more and more of us are starting to understand is that Indigenous, First Nations, treaty rights, and Aboriginal title are the most powerful legal barrier to the plans to just flay this continent. And those rights become more powerful when there are mass movements defending them. and when they are embraced by whole societies. And this is really starting to change. And I think it's actually changing the way we think, as well as the way we fight. Because I think that it's about more than, and it has to be about more than just a sort of extractive relationship to those rights. Like, those rights are useful to us because they help us protect our water, so we want to use those rights. That's exactly the wrong way of thinking about this. That these are rights that come out of a vision of how to live well, that were hard won and hard protected, and they point us towards a non-extractive, regeneration-based way of living on this planet. And that is the most hopeful and exciting part of this new wave of activism. Now, this can sound overwhelming. Anything about climate change can sound overwhelming, and it's certainly easier to talk about changing light bulbs than changing the economy. But here's what we need to remember. It's not like we're talking about an economy that is working beautifully except for the small matter of rising sea levels. We're talking about allowing sea levels to rise in the name of protecting an economic system that is failing the vast majority of the people on this planet with or without climate change. By responding robustly to climate change, in line with what scientists are telling us, we have a once-in-a-century opportunity to solve some of our biggest and most intractable social and economic problems. We can create countless good unionized jobs in the next economy. Every dollar invested in renewable energy, efficiency, public transit creates 6 to 8 times as many jobs as that dollar would create if it went into oil and gas infrastructure. Those jobs can rebuild our ailing public infrastructure, and that infrastructure will give us more livable cities, stronger communities, healthier bodies. We all know this. We can find the money by making polluters pay, whether it's the fossil fuel companies or the bloated defense companies or the financial speculators. To do any of this, of course, we must dramatically reduce the power of corporate money in politics. Now, everybody who is trying to get anything done in this country that is in any way vaguely progressive, whether it's fighting private prisons or for gun control or universal health care, knows that money in politics is the single greatest barrier. The question that I'm left with is whether climate change can provide the big tent that we need to build a new kind of coalition and put us on a science-based deadline and tell us that we cannot afford to lose. I think it can, and I'll tell you why. The atmosphere is already our big tent. We are already under this big tent, and we have to start acting like it. Because underneath all of this is the truth that we've been avoiding. Climate change isn't an issue to add to the list of things to worry about next to healthcare and taxes. It's a civilizational wake-up call, a powerful message spoken in the language of fires, floods, droughts, and extinction, telling us that we need an entirely new economic model and a new way of sharing this planet, telling us that we need to evolve. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Naomi Klein speaking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. She spoke in Seattle in September 2014. Special thanks to Pirate TV and Jen Chien. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.